Mark.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very, very good.
Excellent, excellent. Good to be talking with you.
Likewise. First
are you time. Are you in New York?
I'm in Washington.
You're in Washington. Are you guys having the same terrible weather?
Well, right now it's just kind of gloomy and humid and, you know, periodic thunderstorms, which we look forward to.
Excellent, so, excellent, nice. Yeah, it's a downpour outside today,
okay.
So this is terrible. I should say I'm Stephen Spruill, staff writer for the National Review and National Review Online.
And I'm Mark Schmidt. I'm the executive editor of the American Prospect and American Prospect Online.
Excellent. Well, I guess we can get started with news that just broke this morning, kind of right before this Blogging Heads TV recording session began, and this is the passing of George Steinbrenner.
Right, right. A major figure for some of us who grew up as Yankees fans, and one of the few people that I'm willing to make an exception for not speaking ill of the dead. But but
really?
At the same time, just reading a few things today as a reminder that Greg Sargent, I guess, had a lovely little piece over at the Post about going to Yankees games with his father in the late 70s and how it really was it was something that was significant for the city at a time when most everything else in New York was kind of a mess. That's a phenomenon captured. There's a wonderful book called Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning, which is about the politics of New York in 1977 and the huge blackout that summer, and then also about the Yankees, which were, they were chaotic and they were crazy, but it gave people something else to focus on. And I guess you sort of have to appreciate Steinbrenner for that.
Sure, but then what about the downside? And I should say for our viewers that I'm not much of a baseball fan, and I'm a New York transplant. Only been here for about 5 years, so
yeah.
So double trouble, and not that many opinions on Steinbrenner, but certainly have encountered my share of Yankees fans who have the love hate thing going on. So
right,
so what
right.
what about what about the other?
Well, I was born in New York. I didn't grow up there. I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, which was, sort of contested territory between Yankees and Red Sox. But I did grow up a Yankees fan, and I'm more of a Yankees fan today because my daughter is a diehard Yankees fan. The dark sides of Steinbrenner. I remember being just a kid when this happened, or a teenager, and in 1980. The Yankees won 103 games, and Steinbrenner, as he always did, decided to fire his manager, who was a guy named Dick Houser. And what I always remember that this just struck me so powerfully, and it's always been a little lesson in life to me. Steinbrenner made Houser sit there in a meeting with reporters and say, "I'm resigning from managing the Yankees because there are real estate opportunities in Florida that I want to take advantage of. I want to go into real estate in Florida." And the reporters kept asking, "Well, if Mr. Steinbrenner had asked you to stay, would you stay?" And he kind of kept doing this no comment. It was a real reminder that ritual that I think happens so much in business and all kinds of things, where people are sort of are told, like, it's as if it's a privilege to resign instead of being fired. And the humiliation that people then are put through, to pretend that they've actually resigned for some real estate opportunity in Florida. And of course, 6 months later, he took another managing job, and I think won the World Series or did very well. I think that was with the Kansas City Royals. So it's just always, it's always stuck with me as, if I'm ever in that position. I don't think I've ever been in that position where I've been told, we're firing you, or you can resign. But I've always felt like if I ever am, I'm going straight for it. You got to fire me.
Right.
I do think there's a certain dignity about that. And I remember when there was a great controversy when Star Jones, who was on The View, show, the Barbara Walters show, which I'm not a big watcher of, but she created this great drama by saying, I think Barbara Walters is kind of in charge of that show. It's like, you can fire, you, we're not playing that game. You fire me. You want me gone, you fire me. And I've always, I've always really admired that move. I think partly as a result of that early Steinbrenner lesson. And then, of course, the other, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, where there's always the famous, you can't fire me, I quit.
I quit, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Or I'm suspending myself at full pay.
Right, right.
That's the tactic I would use.
Yeah. And then, of course, I always do a lot of stuff on, I've done a lot of work on campaign finance reform, and I never, and of course, being a big liberal, the thing you always know about Steinbrenner is that he was convicted for illegal campaign contributions to Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. And I realized this morning, you know, I don't actually know that much about that. I mean, I know those facts. I didn't know much more than that, so I kind of dug into it a little bit. It's kind of an interesting. I mean, the first thing that occurred to me, but thinking about it further, was, you know, back in 1972, there weren't that many things that were illegal. You know, I mean, that's before you had the major campaign finance law. There were no limits on individual contributions. So it's like, how do you actually break the law back then? And it's interesting because what he did was use corporate money from his shipbuilding company. So he had a bunch of his executives make $25,000 contributions to the committee to reelect the president. And
those are some of the older laws on.
And
the
then
books,
reimbursed
no, no
them.
Corporate money.
And then reimbursed them. So you're running into the no corporate money, which is it's kind of an interesting question. Like what prevented him from using his own money, especially as I think it's a privately held company, so there's sort of, he had plenty of money. I think part of it actually was that he'd actually been a big Democrat and a big Democratic contributor and a big pal of Ted Kennedy's, and historically, apparently his record is that he always supported Democrats. But at that moment, he needed a lot of help from the Nixon administration for stuff involving either the shipbuilding business or I guess there was a shipping company business on the Great Lakes, and he had all kinds of regulatory issues he needed to deal with. So he needed to get in good with the administration. So maybe he didn't want to show up as so obviously as a personal big massive donor to Nixon when he had these other relationships. So, you know, as with many things, it's more complicated than I thought.
Well, I mean, I've found that to be a very interesting dynamic when you have people who are, I guess, constitutionally or maybe culturally liberal, progressive people, people who, for the most part, disagree with Republicans and conservatives on cultural issues, on social issues. And yet it's often in their best interest to have Republicans elected. And here I'm thinking about all of the Wall Street money that Barack Obama and the Democrats got in 2006 and 2008, in particular, giving from hedge fund managers and other types like that, private equity fund guys, was startlingly lopsided.
Right.
But then you look at the lobbying groups that represent these people in Washington, the Managed Funds Association and the like, and their giving is lopsided to Republicans. So it's kind of like they're canceling each other out simply because, you know, these are Manhattanites, or if they're not, if they don't live in Manhattan, a lot of times they live in San Francisco. Even the hedge fund managers who live in Dallas were big givers to Democrats personally, and then their lobbying groups in the meantime were just frustrated. I asked some of them about it at the time, and they were just no comment. They do what they do, and we do what we do. Right. But it could have been a similar thing with Steinbrenner. You know, he himself leaned to the left,
moderate left.
Living in New York, it's also a social thing as well. You know, I'm sure that many of his friends and people he associated with.
Well, I don't think he ever really lived in New York. I think, you know, his business was in Ohio. Like near Cleveland, and I think he mostly lived in Florida. I was never, mm-hmm. I don't, you know, he wasn't a guy you saw at hanging out at Studio 54 or whatever back in the, back when I hung out there.
That's too bad, right?
Or Limelight or whatever was the. No, I mean, I don't think he was a cultural liberal. I think he was I actually think he was a kind of Ohio, just a fairly standard issue. Democrat, and then he had this regulatory this is really just from what I read this morning, had this regulatory issue. I don't think it's quite as nuanced as the hedge fund guys. The hedge fund guys are pretty interesting. I mean, it's a good reminder that often people will, you know, do like the big The big database and say, look, all this money from Goldman Sachs, counting all their employee, their PAC plus all their individual employees, is all going to these Democrats and so forth. But it's a good reminder that even when people are really wealthy, or in many ways, especially when they're really wealthy, they have lots of interests other than the narrow interests of the firm they happen to work for.
That's right. That's right. It's kind of the flip side of the Thomas Frank argument. The what's the matter with Kansas? It's like what's the matter with Greenwich? People's political leanings are not always tied to their financial interests. Although, you could argue that look, these guys felt like we've got Chris Dodd as the chair of the Senate Banking Committee. We've got Chuck Schumer, a very powerful senator. Our interests will basically be protected, and then we'll get to vote our conscience on all kinds of issues that where we side more with the Democrats. Issues like stem cell research and various other issues where you can see how. Someone like a money manager, living in an urban area and very smart and thinking, that if smart people like, himself or herself were in charge of the government, then you could engineer a solution to all of these social problems. And you can see how someone like that would tend to lean left. And so they can vote their conscience without having to worry about, carried interest was protected for a long time. And it still is. Right. Does financial regulation bill change the taxation of that?
No, I don't think so. Pretty sure it doesn't. I know it doesn't. No, well, yeah. I would go much further and argue that for people in that business, carried interest isn't the biggest. These little special tax breaks they get aren't the biggest factor in their prosperity, and that in fact, Democratic government, they did very, very well when Bill Clinton was president. I think they've probably done better with Obama than they would have with a Republican president. And I think their overall interest is economic growth and a reasonable climate in which to work. I think that they are they're fine. And I don't expect their lobbyist trade association to necessarily see it that way.
That's
going to be part of the kind of Republican business establishment. But there's a tremendous short-sightedness, I think, on the part of business about just what who actually is on the side of their prosperity.
Right. Without taking issue with too much that you just said there, I think the flip side of that argument could be made to counter Thomas Frank's thesis. You could say that. It's not necessarily in the best interest of some of the people that he talks about in Red America who are voting against their own economic interests by voting for Republicans. People have aspirations. They hope one day to work and save and invest and become and move up into those higher tax brackets, and they don't necessarily see it as consistent with their economic interests to vote for the party that wants to raise tax rates in those brackets, that's just one narrow issue, but there are a variety of other economic issues where it's not always consistent to say that just because these people are in a lower income group, they should necessarily vote for the Democrats every time.
Right. Well, there are two things about that. One problem with Frank, and this is such an old argument now, is where you're defining working class. So the people he was, actually low income people vote overwhelmingly Democratic, and they do it everywhere. There's a kind of middle tier which can be defined as working class based on education. There are different ways of defining it, but they're actually not doing that badly in terms of income. So it's not like they're certainly in a position where they can think about a range of other interests and concerns they have. It's not like you can say, God, they definitely ought to be voting on their economic interests because they're really screwed otherwise. So,
right.
So it's not necessarily. I don't accept that they're voting on their economic interest, but their interest is in what's going to happen to them when they're in the 35% tax bracket, which they're not in and probably aren't going to be in. Maybe people imagine themselves in that bracket. I tend to think people have more of a general. People say, well, why is it? There isn't a huge amount of political unrest about economic inequality in this country. That's a reality at almost any level. Is it that people expect they're going to be in that, you know, George Steinbrenner class, or is it more like they kind of accept that in a dynamic economy there are going to be some big winners, and that's kind of not even the price you pay. That's the reality of a growing dynamic economy that creates opportunities for a lot of people. I think that's probably more where people's instincts are.
Right.
And I don't think I've seen any polling. I've actually looked at it. I haven't seen any polling that's very dispositive in either direction between those two. But I think that you know the idea that you know you want to be LeBron James, go be LeBron James. You know, go for it.
is
very American. I you don't have to be. It's actually not the fact that every million he gets is $1,000 that 1,000 people don't have. I mean, it's really not.
That's right. That's right. Although it's funny, you know, this became a topic on the right. You mentioned LeBron James, and you know how,
because we had a plan to talk about baseball free agency and basketball free agency. So I'm kind of trying to move it back to the plan.
I noticed that. That's the savvy veteran move. As a newcomer to blowing heads, I did pick up on that though. So we did have this plan because one of the things that, like I said, I grew up in Texas. To the extent I was a fan of any team, it was the Rangers, and the Rangers always getting beat by the Yankees in the playoffs. And there's a lot of griping about how because of the salary cap structure in baseball, the big market teams could always go out and purchase the best free agents,
and then
Texas tried that, and they went and spent $250 million on A-Rod, and it didn't exactly work out so well, and it hasn't actually worked out just like that for the Yankees. I mean, it took them I believe 6 years after they acquired A-Rod to actually win a World Series, and then when they did, it had to do with other factors. That team, to the extent that I watched, it seemed to really gel and have chemistry and play well together. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, a lot of people were saying was going to be impossible with the Miami Heat when you had LeBron James decide to go there. Because they said, first of all, the salary cap in basketball is very different from the salary cap in baseball. It's much more rigid. Mm-hmm. And so if you have three players like LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh, who are all demanding max money, that's not going to leave any room under the salary cap for other players. So you're going to have three right. alpha dogs, and then a bunch of minimum, like bunch of guys making the league minimum, trying to support them, and they're not going to be able to win a championship that way. But it's been really surprising, because what you've seen instead of what was expected is that all three of those top players agreed to take less money in order to sign with Miami.
Right.
And in order to make sure that Miami could sign good players in addition to them. Then you also had yesterday Udonis Haslam, who's one of the forwards for Miami, turned down about $14 million in terms of a better offer that was made to him by both the Dallas Mavericks and the Denver Nuggets, and signed for $14 million less just so that he could play in Miami.
Right.
And then Mike Miller, who was one of his teammates on the Florida Gators college team, also took less money to sign in Miami. This was not expected by anyone. Everyone in the sports commentary had said, you know, LeBron James, first of all, he's going to stay in Cleveland because they can afford to pay him the most money. Mm-hmm. Second of all, after he chose Miami,
well I didn't see that much. I didn't follow it quite that closely, but I didn't see a lot of people who thought that it was most likely that he would stay in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. I saw a few. That was definitely. I mean, that for a period of time, anyway, that seemed to be the dominant view, particularly
right.
after he said that he was going to do this, this television special, because
right.
nobody really thought that he would actually have a television special and then go on TV and rip the heart out of his hometown. They
right.
thought, look, if he's going to leave, he's going to sneak out the back door and do it quietly. He wouldn't hold an hour-long TV show just to announce that he's leaving Cleveland. But that's what he did.
Right.
Anyways,
right.
I guess the point is that
I'm doing it on Blogging Heads. I'm doing my when I make my move, Blogging Heads will have the
room. Oh, that's right. An hour long. Okay. Should yeah. we do? Is this Mark Schmidt the decision?
We'll get Jim Gray. You know, I'll get Kaus. We'll get Kaus back. Play the Jim Gray role. I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you.
I think that's a good idea. No, I mean, this was not going anywhere in particular, just to say that because everybody thought that because of the salary cap structure in basketball, that this was a just a purely selfish move by LeBron to go and to Miami and try to win a title, and that it wasn't going to work because nobody was going to agree to play for less money. But instead, you've had a number of players agreeing to take less money, and the team looks like it might actually have some good chemistry. It might be able to win a title, which is going to disappoint a lot of people in Cleveland because they're rooting for Miami to fail.
Well, I mean, I guess I have to ask you. I mean, I'm, you know, this is kind of interesting. All, yeah, it's less money. It's also all in the zone of kind of crazy, insane money that, you know, your life. There's only so much more you can do with so many more millions. Pretty soon, you know, unless you start really getting into your having your own plane, which chews up a lot of money. But everything else is, you know, you really can't figure out how to spend at that level. I'm just curious, what's the official conservative position on these questions?
Well, let me. In fact, I'm glad that you asked, because I was going to bring that up. There was for a time a couple of people on the right who were trying to make an issue of the fact that Florida has no state income tax. Whereas Ohio has a 6% income tax, New York obviously has a state income tax, and New York City has an income tax of, I think it's 3.5% on everything above $90,000. So, now look, I mean, I think that that's a good point in other contexts, right? I mean, in the context of, you know, do tax rates in various jurisdictions have an effect on whether or not businesses choose to locate there? I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but I know that the exodus of Fortune 500 companies from New York City to other states over the last 50 years has been, you know, quite pronounced. But I just don't think that was an issue here. I think it's a good try, you know, to take this very newsy event that everybody's talking about and make a point about tax competition. But at the same time, LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, if the reporting from the Cleveland Plain Dealer is to be trusted, and they've had some fantastic stories about this, have been talking about making this move since 2006. They're friends. They like each other. They want to play together, and they want to win championships. And so I don't think taxes had much to do with it. But if you want your conservative policy angle, there it is.
That's what it is. Okay. But, I mean, I guess I was more curious about, A, the idea that people should not pursue the most they can get, B, the kind of elaborate, complicated restraint of trade that governs this particular system of free agency and creates all these kind of idiosyncratic situations, as opposed to, you know, a free-for-all. That's, you know, as it was at the beginning of free agency, in the era when Steinbrenner started bringing in Reggie Jackson and Catfish Hunter and all these and all these folks, where it's just a matter of, you know, why not let people let owners throw as much money as they want into at these situations. Why isn't the conservative position be, you know, get government out of the way?
I mean, that's a very good question, and in fact, it's something that a lot of my Yankee fan friends who are on the left, you know, often say to me if I'm ever complaining about salary cap issues in baseball. They're like, I thought you were the free market guy. What happened to let everybody compete? Yeah. And if they can afford to pay their players the most. I mean, you know, the difference is that it's not, you know, this is not something that's imposed by a government. It's a decision that the league has made, presumably for the purposes of marketing its sport, right? And they've decided as a business that their sport is more marketable if there's more parity in the league among teams, and big markets can't just monopolize all of the best players. And I think that is a situation where you are seeing the market work. You see competition among sports. You know, you have sports with very rigid salary cap structures where there's arguably more parity, like basketball. And then you have sports with looser salary cap structures, such as baseball, where there's less parity. You have a few powerhouse teams and then some perennial also-rans, as I know very well as a Texas Rangers fan.
There's an owner I love to hate.
right. Well, I think he's finally gone. They brought in a different ownership. But another interesting policy angle that I'd be interested to get your thoughts on is that because George Steinbrenner died this year, and not saying that there's any silver lining at all for his family. I don't mean to suggest that, but it is interesting as a policy question that because he died this year,
this is the year.
There's no estate tax.
That's right. This is the year to die.
There's no estate tax.
Right. If you have wealthy relatives who are, you know, almost gone.
This is something where when this is turned around on conservatives, I don't understand it, because there's absolutely no reason why this tax has to be reimposed. You can just leave it expired and let that money, you know, reenter the economy. None of the heirs of these people are just going to be burying piles of money in their backyard or sitting on it in safes. It's going to be reinvested, and presumably there will be multiplier effects when it's invested. So I mean, I don't see why you need to take it out of the economy. It's not like it would be idle otherwise.
Well, there's not much. There's not going to be multiplier effects because it's not going to move from where it is. You know. If there's a bunch of dollars sitting in stock and bonds, it's just going to stay largely where it is. I mean, unless the heirs, you know, yank it out and start spending like crazy.
Knowing heirs, you know.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I just read this very long article that you wrote about, you know, all the long-term problems of the deficit. There's nobody in a million years who thinks that we can afford that. That's why there's an agreement that something has to be done around the estate tax, and in a way that at this point is, you know, even given the Democratic positions, is going to be something that affects a very, very tiny percentage of families. So I mean, the real absurdity is to have allowed this game to be created where, to avoid the long term costs of actually doing that, the Congress in the Bush years created this phony thing where they take it to zero and then the whole thing expires and it goes back up to the 35% level it doesn't go all the way back up to 50, but it goes up to the previous level. And
not right.
And you know, I mean, I think it's perfectly reasonable as income passes, in whatever form you get it, you know, this is, you know, I'm a tax reform purist. If you get money from your job, you get money from capital gains, you get money from dividends, you get money from, you know, you get a phone call that, you know, the great uncle you never heard of just left you $500,000. As far as I'm concerned, I don't care what it is. It should all be taxed at the same level. So I would, you know, I'd be happy to have an inheritance tax rather than taxing the estate itself. There are differences, but we, you know, historically we've had the structure of the estate tax. I don't think there's any reason why that money should be untaxed when, you know, the money you make from work is taxed, the money any blue collar worker makes is taxed. I mean, there's just no reason for that kind of what in most situations is quite literally unearned income. Should be taxed.
But it was earned. I mean, it was earned the first time that, you know, that the person who's passing it on earned it. It's already been taxed as income, is I guess what I'm saying. So
well, the base of it is, some of it's been taxed, but most of the income hasn't. Most of that's investment income.
But then presumably it's been taxed, or it would be taxed as soon as it was realized. As soon as the gains were realized from the sale of those assets, it would be taxed at the capital gains rate. Although I think you make a very good point about taxing all income at the same rate. I'm not sure that I would tax income from estates or inheritances because of not only just this issue of double taxation, but also there are other distortionary effects involved, and you know, I mean, there are ways to get around that tax, but they involve a lot of inefficient deployments of capital. But you know, look, I mean, the point that you make about taxing all income at the same rate is a good one. I think you do avoid a lot of distortions there.
That's as good an answer as any. But it is interesting that there's that we've created this bizarre situation where you know a death today is very different from an estate today is just very different from what it was last year or next year. I mean, I just think that's talk about a distortionary effect. Obviously, nobody's going to act on it.
right.
Although, you know, boy, if you're sitting there with somebody with a living will on December 31st, it's hard to imagine people don't think about it a little bit if there's an enormous amount of wealth there.
It would cross the mind.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's just a crazy kind of situation to have created. And I've been angry about it for, you know, as long as it's been going on. It is amazing. I mean, it is an amazing thing, I think. When the conservative campaign against the estate tax and the renaming of the death tax and the, you know, the enormous campaign that was really successful at convincing a lot of Democrats, including a lot of liberal Democrats, that to oppose the estate tax on the grounds that it, you know, hurt small businesses, that it would, I remember, you know, when I lived in New York, my, the congresswoman who represented me, Nydia Velasquez of Brooklyn, had been convinced for some period of time that, you know, the little bodegas on the corner were going to be taxed out of existence when their owners passed on, which is a huge, and so she was a supporter originally of a state tax repeal. It was shocking, and it's amazing given how well structured and well funded that campaign was, that, you know, here we are, and we will have an estate tax next year, and I think that's just. I think it's totally fair, but it's actually kind of a political miracle, given how successful on the surface how successful that campaign against it was.
I mean, I think the miraculous the source of the miracle is the deficit situation that we're in. I think that if we did not have those fiscal pressures, it would be hard to renew that tax, just as it would be hard to let others of the Bush tax cuts expire. But as it happens, we're in a situation where there are enormous pressures to balance the budget. This is what I took from Barack Obama's statement at the G20 a couple of weeks ago, when he said, "I'm going to be calling Republicans bluff. They've been talking about the need to reduce the deficit, and I'm going to present some hard choices to the nation next year, and I'm going to be calling their bluff, and if they're really serious about the deficit, they'll get on board." I mean, obviously, there are, you know, the structure that your austerity package takes really makes a huge difference in terms of its effects on economic growth. Mm-hmm. And we've heard a lot about, you know, about how we absolutely can't, you know, cut back on deficit spending right now because, you know, you have this phenomenon on the left that's kind of equivalent to, you know, extreme hyperbolic supply-siderism on the right, the people who say that, you know, tax cuts can always pay for themselves. And now we've got people saying that government spending, you know, can actually in certain instances, not pay for itself, but, you know, provide enough revenue, a big enough multiplier effect to really have significant impact on revenue. And I just think that's not true, and it's not borne out by empirical studies we have of other fiscal consolidations. So, I mean, my point is that there would be enormous pressure to leave the estate tax lapsed, mm-hmm. and to renew the Bush tax cuts if we were not in such a dire fiscal situation. But since we are, I'm afraid that the pressure is going to be working the other way. And politically, Obama's going to be able to say, "Well, I thought you were concerned about the deficit." And, you know, that's going to, unfortunately, that's going to resonate.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there won't be. I think Obama understands. I mean, I think you're mixing up a couple different points here. And I want to actually get to some of the things that you wrote in the article that's, I guess, in the forthcoming or maybe the currently available issue of National Review, which I read online. On the one hand, I think there will be a resistance to. There has been a resistance to immediately, allowing the tax cuts to to be repealed. I mean, there will be a lot of extenders, and there will be a protection of everything under $250,000. And I think we've certainly seen that. And there have been additional tax. You know, there were very significant tax cuts as part of the first stimulus package, and there will probably be some, although a smaller amount, if we were to do a second. I mean, I think at a certain point, whether you say it will all pay for itself or not, I don't worship at the church of long-term economic projections or long-term fiscal projections, but you know, one way or another, what this economy needs right now is growth. And without growth, and especially if we go into a double dip recession, you know, go into the second dip, without that level of growth, we're certainly going to be worse off in terms of revenues, right?
I mean, agreed. It's hard not absolutely. To argue. Absolutely. I don't argue with that.
So that the highest priority has to be, keep economic growth, put as much of a kind of platform under the economy as you can to keep growth going and give it the biggest boost possible, right?
Sure. The difference of opinion, I mean, between left and right, is just what policies are most conducive to growth, right? I mean, that's I think the difference, where you have on the one hand a belief that Keynesian multipliers are larger for government spending than for tax cuts, because of the multiplier effects. Because the money is spent immediately and into the economy, whereas tax cuts could be saved. And then on the right, you have the tax cuts more effective, particularly tax rate cuts. You know, there's a big difference between the rebate checks that were sent out as part of the stimulus and actually cutting the rate on at which income is taxed, because of the incentive effects of tax cuts. And that's down to the very basic.
What's the incentive that people are going to get now in the current economy from a tax rate cut?
There is. Right. So I don't think there's any appetite to cut tax rates. I mean, I don't think we're going to see that. But what we have right now is a lot of uncertainty about what tax rates are going to be in the future, because we have no idea. You know, I mean, they've punted all of these decisions to this debt commission, and we have the looming expiration of these tax rate cuts. So, you know, it's made it very difficult for people to plan. So I think, you know, Even if we're planning on letting some of the tax rate cuts expire, as Obama has said he favors, we also don't know what the composition of Congress is going to be. So that could also play into it. So I think that if we had a plan for reducing the deficit, we announced it sooner rather than later. I mean, I think at least there you would have. If not incentive effects, you would have at least more certainty and less cash sitting on the sidelines, because people would be able to plan.
Right. I think that's I think the planning argument is a reasonable one. And I think that it's very different from saying that if you were to reduce tax rates now as your form of economic stimulus, that's not going to be an incentive for investment, because there's in the current climate, because there's lots of money sitting on the sidelines, until demand picks up, and it's not going to be incentive to work. I mean, people can't work harder. They can't work harder than they do in the current economy, because the employment isn't there. So I don't think it's an incentive in that sense. I understand the idea that a more predictable path for business, which I think I've always thought that's a very strong value. I thought that was a very strong value in health reform, for business to have health costs that are reasonably predictable, and I think they will get that. I think that's very pro-business policy. The reason that tax policies are unpredictable in the current climate is you have an administration which would have a reasonable plan and could work with this commission, and you have a Republican Party which is determined to resist all of it. I mean, that's the reason for the uncertainty. The uncertainty isn't an economic policy. It's a political problem.
Well, yeah, but I mean, wait a minute. But you could very easily reverse it, right, and say there are areas on which Republicans and Democrats could agree, but the Democrats are insisting on doing it one particular way. I mean, you can't just say that the only reason we have uncertainty is Republicans won't just lie down and let Obama do whatever he wants. You know, I mean, because we have different values, we have different views of what kinds of policies are conducive to economic growth. So, I mean, yeah, we do have uncertainty because of political disagreements. But certainly there are ways. This is regardless of what you think about extending unemployment benefits. I don't think unemployment insurance is the worst federal program that we have by far. But at the same time, you have Republicans who are insisting that we cannot continue to run record-breaking $1 trillion-plus deficits year after year. We have to start finding a way to pay for these things. Mm-hmm. And right now, we just don't have a lot of evidence that the Stimulus Act, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 has been very effective. It certainly hasn't delivered on its promises. So what they're saying is let's cancel some of that money and use it to fund unemployment benefits now. I personally don't see what the problem is there. That's a proposal that could get Republican votes immediately. And yet, if you're going to argue that Republicans are obstructing for political reasons, I think it's just as easily argued that Harry Reid continues to force failed votes on unemployment benefits because he feels like maybe there's some political value in continually getting Republicans on the record against unemployment insurance extensions.
Well, or getting them to think twice about what is kind of a crazy policy where you're going to officially, instead of saying in the long term we will put a plan in place that, over the economic cycle and when this recession is over will put us on a better fiscal path. Instead of that, there's an insistence that with the dollar that we put into the economy, we insist on taking a dollar out when the state and local cuts are already, a complete counter-stimulus. And Harold Meyerson wrote this in our magazine, Ezra Klein wrote it the other day. I mean, you're already having a situation where the stimulus is already completely countered by the state and local cuts. And then if you insist that an unemployment extension be paid for by reducing current spending, you have the same thing. Maybe you have the unemployment insurance, which is a valuable thing for people who've been working for a long time in their lives. These are the idea that people are content to be unemployed is really deeply offensive when you're talking about you cannot be eligible for unemployment insurance unless you have a track record as a worker. These are not lazy people. Maybe that's just a valuable thing, and maybe some other spending is less valuable. But there is no economic stimulus at that point. You're certainly not doing anything to encourage growth. So I mean,
that's right. That's from the point. That's spoken from the point of view, though, that government spending and Keynesian economic stimulus has these multiplier effects, which are very effective. When actually, I don't think that's the case. I think what's really counteracted the stimulus is this residual weakness in the banking sector that, because of a variety of factors, I think, just confusion over what to do about it, a political inability to solve the problem. I think that if Obama had taken the steps that were necessary in 2009, Republicans would have cried from the rooftops that he was nationalizing the banks. But we have a very, very weak banking sector that's still undergoing massive deleveraging. If you want to talk about what's counteracting the stimulus, that's it. But really, that's to buy into a false frame, because this idea that government spending is really going to boost the economy, for that to work, you have to think that all of this money that the government borrowing is just idle cash that is just sitting there. It's in the the form of cash that's being stored somewhere.
Well, when you can borrow
even
zero.
Even cash equivalents are a lot of times they're short-term investment mm-hmm. vehicles, very short-term, but that money is circulating in the economy. The government is just taking it out and spending it on something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not. I mean, when it's borrowing, when it's able to borrow at zero, and when you have, I mean, obviously, if you had a little quantitative easing at the Fed, the whole thing would be even easier. We have no concern about inflation right now. We're able to borrow at zero. There's very little immediate cost to putting that money into the economy, where it does actually result in the kind of spending and demand that is necessary to get out of a recession. I mean, in your article, you say Keynesian macroeconomics is not without its application. applications, and I was reading that and thinking, well, if its applications aren't here, when are they? You know, I mean, I do understand. You know,
go ahead.
I mean, Keynesian macroeconomics is about how you break a cycle of, you know, of insufficient demand. That's what it's about. It's not, you know, it doesn't necessarily apply to every economic situation, but it certainly does to this one.
I disagree. I mean, I think in a typical recession, there's a typical business cycle recession when inventories get ahead of demand, and you have this hangover in output, and that causes cutbacks and layoffs. You know, then there's a case to be made for at least some kind of policy of easing of tax rates, cutting of interest rates, that sort of typical macroeconomic policy. This is a balance sheet recession. It's a recession that's driven by weakness in the banking sector and a hugely over-leveraged public that just has to be paying down debts right now. I mean, no politician wants to be the one that says we have to accept a leg down because we got insanely over-leveraged during a massive speculative bubble in real estate. But that's right. That's what's happening, unfortunately, and there's just very little that the government can do about it, other than to pursue policies that are otherwise conducive to growth, like in normal times, like tax rate cuts. Now, I mean, I think Kevin Drum had a really interesting proposal the other day, and I'd be interested in getting your thoughts on this, because this is only one of a number of kind of grand bargains that I think, you know, conservatives and liberals could work together on. His proposal was scrap the corporate income tax, because it really just is a drag on business activity. Corporations are not taxpayers, they're tax collectors. They collect the taxes from their employees, from their shareholders, and from their consumers in the form of higher costs. And so if you eliminate this tax, you immediately increase the value of every business in the country, and you make it easier for them to do business. And you replace that lost revenue with a carbon tax and a financial transactions tax. You have these two areas where, you know, externalities are arguably insufficiently priced, and so you can make up the lost revenue that way. I'm not sure I would support that exact proposal, but I think some of these trade-offs, like to get back to your point of taxing all income at the same rate and then figuring out how do we get that right so that it's revenue neutral, I think there are areas for compromise there.
I've actually made that proposal myself. I've thought it made you can't quite match the revenue, but if you get rid of the corporate income tax and then you bring up the capital gains rate and the dividend rate to the same rate as income from labor, and then you'd still need some revenue, and that's where you could use a carbon tax or a financial transaction tax, which I also think is a great idea. I think that's a terrific proposal, and I think the great thing about it is it gets where the largest amount of both political gamesmanship and accounting gamesmanship and fraud goes on is in two areas. One is evading the corporate income tax, and two is all the carried interest is a tactic for shifting something that's plainly plainly employee compensation over into something that gets classified as capital gains, even though the employees actually don't have any capital at risk. But that's the gimmick. That's the whole gimmick. Well, that gimmick is gone, and so are all the other gimmicks. If you do a deal like that, and I'm totally open to that. I don't know. I mean, it would be interesting to see Obama, instead of going straight down the road of the deficit commission, had gone down the road of we're going to have a tax reform commission, and see if you said, hey, let's talk about eliminating the corporate income tax and then doing these other things, I'd like to see if you get a single Republican to salute that. I don't know. It'd be worth the experiment.
Well, that's where it's going to be difficult. You know, as I said before, I was open to some pretty radical ideas back in early 2009 with regard to what to do about the banking sector, and none of that happened. And I think it's arguably because, one reason is because, Obama brought on an entire team that was highly connected to Wall Street and highly biased toward the status quo, but also because there was a legitimate fear there that if you started taking over banks and forcing, recapitalizations, then, he would be accused of nationalizing the banks, even if those banks were quickly turned around and put back to work, making credit available to the economy.
Right.
Look, I mean, I think all of this argument over Keynesian stimulus is important, but it's happening at the margins of a much larger problem that I feel like is not getting very much attention at all. Mm-hmm. And that bothers me somewhat, but that's the larger problem being
the housing sector or the global?
The housing sector, the weakness in the banking system. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal just this weekend about how the primary difference between countries that have gotten back on the path to job creation and countries that have not is, two factors: weakness in the banking sector and how indebted the public, like public indebtedness, outstanding credit in the economy. And there's just for a number of years in this country, the savings rate was negative, and that's just not a very good, healthy way for an economy to function. But as far as what comes out of this debt commission, I'm afraid it's going to be very pedestrian. But I like that, not to pat ourselves on the back too much, but I like that, people at the American Prospect and National Review are talking about these other kind of interesting swaps and bargains and ways to make tax policy more fair and then maybe you wouldn't have these conversations when George Steinbrenner dies about estate taxes and how 2010 is definitely the year to die.
right. No, I think that's absolutely right. If instead of these old farts like Alan Simpson, you put people like you and me in charge of some of these commissions, maybe we'd get some results.
This is it. We could do it live on ESPN and talk about the Schmitz-Brule decision. We're going to solve. Give us a couple hours. We'll figure all this stuff out.
All right, that sounds good. This is one of the most optimistic. I think we need to end on that optimistic. how we're going to roll up our sleeves. We never met before. We didn't really meet now except on the phone. But we're going to roll up our sleeves and fix this country's problems.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Likewise. Bye bye.
Take care.